In this week's programme, the King James Bible and the English language. David Crystal, an expert in linguistics who has written numerous books about the English language, calls his book about the influence of the King James Version Begat. He refers to six other translations ranging from Wycliffe at the end of the 14th century to the Douay at the beginning of the 17th. None of these, he tells us, reached as many people as the King James, which was published in 1611. Crystal says that apart from Shakespeare, no other single source has provided the English language with so many idiomatic expressions as the Bible. He discovered that the King James Version popularised these idioms, but originated less than 10% of them. Besides, he says, idiom is only one feature of style. The author concludes that the larger question of the influence of the King James on literary style is still to be determined. With me, Selina Guinness, who's a lecturer at IADT Dunlea and is co-editor of The Resurrection Manuscript Material by W.B. Yeats, published by Cornell University Press. Terence Brown is a fellow emeritus and former professor of Anglo-Irish literature at Trinity College Dublin. His most recent book, The Literature of Ireland, Culture and Criticism, is published by Cambridge University Press. Selina, fill me in on your early exposure to the King James. What was it?
Well, I went to a Protestant day school and boarding school, and when I was 12 years old, our religious education consisted of a year of learning quotations from the King James Bible, many of which were completely opaque to us. But I find that those rhythms and those words still remain, such as the stars in their courses fought against Sisera from Judges, or hewers of wood and drawers of water. These are things that kind of persist in the memory, I suppose.
As a young Catholic, Terence, I found that I had very little exposure to the Bible. You yourself, tell us about your own early exposure.
I had massive exposure to it. I am the son of evangelical Christian missionaries whose concern was to spread the biblical message in China during the occupation by Japan just before the Second World War. And upon their return to Northern Ireland when I was a little kid, the King James's Bible and the stories and narratives and images were acquired by me literally at my mother's knee. I remember hearing about the children of Israel in the desert having escaped the wrath of Pharaoh and the Red Sea. And I carry to this day the image of children going across the desert as if they were fleeing from school rather from a wicked overlord. And so the narratives, the phrases, the tones are just completely part of my unconscious.
Did they stay with you too, Selina?
Yeah, in a sense, a great mystery. I remember at the time that you could slay anyone with the jawbone of an ass was, you know, something that you might kind of try on a Saturday. But it was, yeah, they stay with you at times when you find yourself in need of a phrase to repeat. Sometimes, you know, I remember climbing mountains, trying to think of a way of getting myself up to the top. And when you want a rhythm to fall into, I find that many of the biblical phrases that I would have learnt then come back to me.
When playing golf as a youngster, putting these things behind me and pressing on with kind of Pauline metaphors would come to your mind in an absurd way, which is something that I think David Crystal captures in his book, the way in which the biblical phrases occupy kind of two or three levels of discourse at the very least. One is kind of elevated, reverential area where phrases from the Bible seem to crop up at moments of piety and solemnity in our culture, but also where they have entered into kind of popular discourse. Phrases recur over and over again in all kinds of zones of speech, from pop music to ad man's copywriting.
Yeah, but what do you make of his point, though, Selina, that it's mainly idioms that have been affected and not style more generally, at least? What's your...
Well, I think he very much proves his point that, you know, there are various idioms that we owe to the King James, and he isolates ones that are specific to King James rather than the other translations which you cited in your introduction. But I thought in some ways that the book was a missed opportunity not to expand his scope and also consider things like the syntax and the grammar, which I'm not sure how particular they are to King James, but they are very. It is a very distinctive form of syntax. I know that the King James is often described as a text that works on a parataktic sentence structure, which means that it juxtaposes it arranges its thought by the juxtaposition of clauses.
Would, for example, many are called and few are chosen? Is that the kind of
that would be it? Yes. Rather than setting up necessarily a kind of hierarchical structure within a sentence where there's a order of subclauses. So when I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, and then there's a big colon. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. In some ways, that is a characteristic, also a characteristic deferral or delay of the main clause. And you would see that in a lot of contemporary American writing, for instance, people like Marilynne Robinson or Cormac McCarthy. And I longed for a bit of literary and stylistic analysis within David Crystal's study.
But in fairness to him, perhaps we just wanted to focus, Terence, on idioms.
Cyril and I are both basically literary
people. We are, I'm afraid.
And that would be naturally our instinct is to think about moments in which we've read and are aware of the kind of biblical source of the writing. However, I think Crystal was engaged in a slightly different project. For me, the book was betwixt and between. On one hand, it was a scholarly academic exercise in which he, as a linguist, was seriously questioning his own earlier statement that this book, the authorised version of the Bible, had more impact on English usage than any other book. And he, as a good academic, came to understand that he hadn't actually tested that. So he set himself the task of testing it. And so there is in this book an excellent small monograph. Wouldn't have been as long as this, in which that test where he reaches a kind of statistical analysis, in which there are 257 examples of idiomatic usage that can be directly attributed to the Bible in English.
Lots of Googling, Selina.
Yeah, I mean, his main form of proof is to demonstrate how biblical expression is used in wordplay. And so his particular love are puns. And he has used the internet widely in finding these puns. So, you know, he will talk about coming across a tattoo parlor called Holier Than Thou, which is one of his funnier ones, such examples.
My own favorite was sufficient until the day are the emails thereof.
I think we all we like enjoyed that one.
Yeah, but just to give an example of his, you know, the Googling, he takes brimstone and fire. Now, a Google search yielded 30,000 in that form, but 500,000 in the usual form of fire and brimstone. I gather the original form was brimstone and fire, but this is what we say. He quotes Joe Biden as giving a new lease of life to gird your loins from Exodus that apparently Joe Biden rallied his supporters with.
This is the other side of his enterprise. The first was the academic one, which he does with considerable skill. And I valued the way in which I learned how limited the number of examples are.
Yes.
Only 18, which you could say that this solely derives from the authorised version. But the other side is this popular, to write a popular book in the 2011.
Well, I mean, for example, when I heard him say, Selina, Leviticus gave us scapegoat, one of the few genuinely biblical words that have entered the language. And I'm saying, wonder, well, you know, what does he mean by that? And would you go along with that?
Yeah, and he further isolates that to Tyndale's translation. But given that the King James Bible is, in any case, 80% based on Tyndale's translation, that in some ways is not surprising. So in some ways, the academic scope of the book is quite limited because if the King James is 80%, certainly 80% of the Old Testament is essentially Tyndale's work, close to Tyndale's work, then he is, you know, those 18 examples of unique usage come from that 20% that is not Tyndale, but only the King James and that committee of translators chaired by Lancelot Andrews. So,
I mean, it's just that notion, that very idea of the few genuinely biblical words that have entered the language.
Well, I think he's right.
You think yes.
And in testing his own case, he finds that really he couldn't claim simply that the authorised version had this extraordinary impact. What he rather claims is the Bible in the various versions
had it.
Given the force of the authorised version being instructed to have it read in church.
He says that the first of the linguistic wildernesses that he found, where there were no sources, was from Deuteronomy to Ruth. The books of Samuel and Kings takes briefly out of that wilderness. He has Samuel's How the Mighty Fallen. And then he says another linguistic wilderness follows Samuel and Kings. When he says as old as the hills, which is an expression we'd use, may have been influenced by Job 15:7. Art thou the first man born, or wast thou made before the hills? Perhaps it was. What do you think, Terence?
Well, I think in his epilogue, he says that these 257 examples that he's given are how he's arrived at it. And he leaves it open that some of these may or may not be directly attributable to the authorised version. I mean, the book is profoundly scholarly. Here's a man who knows English back to Old English, and he's aware.
But your reservations is he's going in the direction, he's trying to strike a popular note at the same time.
He's doing both.
There is a
perfectly respectable, indeed fascinating, linguistic thesis in this, which is the stuff of a small monograph. And then there are the countless examples where he says, here we can see how this phrase has been used in all sorts of areas, from rock music to high politics.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that his method does highlight is, if you like, the secularisation of the Bible in common usage, and particularly also what he calls those expressions where, if you like, the full semantic force has been lost in popular usage. One of his examples is the word charity, and he cites First Book of Peter, where he uses the quotation, charity covers a multitude of sins. And he points out that in that original context, charity means love. But this has degenerated down to quite a narrow use of the word charity. And we now find the idea of charity begins at home to be an utterly self-serving motif. So one of the things that he suggests is if you actually now want to convey the idea of loving your neighbour or love forgiving a multitude of sins, this is actually what you have to use. You have to use the word love. You can no longer use the word charity. And I found that instance of, if you like, loss or narrowness quite instructive.
It's interesting how, on that question of love and charity, I noticed a number of spiritual writers in recent years were objecting to the use of commitment when people meant love. Commitment became a very fashionable term, Terence, to use instead of love.
Because often commitment means that there isn't so much commitment. Love
it's an ironic.
Well, there isn't enough left to sustain.
He makes a distinction between quotations and idioms. You know, he says quotations are context dependent, and gives an example by the rivers of Babylon, as opposed to the skin of my teeth, which is idiomatic.
Well, he's very, very attuned to contemporary usage. Mm. And his scrolling through the internet, which is part of obviously the source of this book, and Googling over and over again, is done with very great acumen. I mean, he knows what he's doing.
I see the origin.
And he obviously loves what he's doing.
Oh, yeah.
And, on one level, this is a book that's really enjoyable, but then it becomes overloaded. Mm. It's rather like working with email and internet itself. You have an informational overload in the text because you're happy enough to hear a few of these puns, but there's some brilliant ones.
Yeah.
The use of, in relation to cardiac conditions, blessed are the pacemakers.
Yes. Yes. That's good. Yes.
That's really brilliant. Then in relation to a new toilet design, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
All dodgy enough. But anyway, I must say I was delighted to see the origin of my name is Legion. I remember the play Captain Cavallo many years ago with Norman Rodway. It was a Globe production. And the character comes in and says, my name, he says, what is your name? He said, my name is Legion. Thank you, Mr. Legion. And it just struck me that it's one of those terms. Would you have thought it off the top of your head that my name is Legion was Mark 5'9"?
Yes, I would.
You would? Yeah, well,
Gospels, I'm afraid,
at
all, yes.
I'm afraid as a child I was rather afraid of being exposed.
Filthy Lucre was there.
There's one interesting claim in the book that really this is a study of the English tradition of English.
But he does
have a couple of instances. Well, he does mention U2 in the book, and he does cite examples from the Irish Independent and the Irish Times as usage, and he makes brief reference.
Yes, U2 felt they weren't. They weren't up to touching the hem of the garment of the Beatles,
correct,
I think, you know.
And he does make brief allusion to the fact that in Ireland there is Irish English, Hiberno-English, as we would call it now, and that there are different forms of usage here. But he doesn't seem to be conscious of the fact that the Bible, in varying different cultures, is vested with completely different significance and meaning.
Yeah.
I mean, in Ireland, the Bible, as you introduced it, was in some sense to be thought a Protestant book.
Yes, yes.
And the use by Catholic...
By the way, on that point, though, he just says it's the New Testament that is the most fruitful here, the most generative of idioms.
Yeah, well, just to come back to what Terence was saying there, where I think that might be a little unfair to him is that he is very attuned to American usages, and he talks about Barack Obama's speeches, and he also then mentions the use of the phrase, like, let my people go within the civil rights movement. I suppose my feeling of dissatisfaction with the book was that, as Terence is right to say, that my expectation was that it would be a slightly different sort of book, a slightly different project, which might call attention to the fact that, you know, when the Puritans left England on the Mayflower, they brought with them the King James Bible, so that what you have in a lot of American usage is actually a very faithful reproduction of the cadences and the idioms and expressions of that text. So,
though, you mentioned writers. Yeah. I think you mentioned McCarthy.
Yeah.
You mentioned Beckett. What is it that you pick up from the Bible in their work?
Well, the complexity of their sentences is one thing in particular. Mm. And Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, I would say, is a text that aims towards a kind of Old Testament air, and you can find wonderfully convoluted sentences in it. Such as here is one from the judge is reflecting on the slaying of Indians, and he says he had long forsworn all weighing of consequence, and allowing as he did that man's destinies are given, yet he usurped to contain within him all that he would ever be in the world and all that the world would be to him, and be his charter written in the earth stone itself. He claimed agency and said so, and he'd drive the remorseless sun onto its final endarkenment as if he had ordered it all ages since, before there were paths anywhere, before there were men or sons to go upon them.
So what precise biblical echo is picked up? Is it essentially a matter of tone? Or?
I suppose it is language, like the idea of usurpation of the words like endarkenment, deliberate archaisms, but also, if you like, you could imagine that as one long verse from Exodus or from one of the prophetic books. You know, there is that sense of also that sense of prophecy that comes through it, which I find interesting. And I would see that as a greater risk and more pervasive in American literature, perhaps, than
Can I hear you on that, Terence?
I find that fascinating, but the problem is that would be a very great book, a huge book, if you were actually to trace the kind of literature in various cultures. But shall we say, in relation to the way in which Beckett uses the Bible in Ireland, plays his radio play All That Fall, which has its title derived directly from the Old Testament psalm, you know, that sense of in Ireland, the Protestant Bible in that is associated with a small minority dying out, and there's a kind of dying fall through the whole text in relation to biblical usage there.
That's a different point, though, isn't it? I mean, that's picking up on a statement about Protestant culture. I mean, what precisely in Beckett do you see as capturing his echoing?
Yeah. Sorry, in fact, one of David Crystal's expressions that he picks out is, woe is me that I sojourn in Mesek, that I dwell in the tents of Kedar. And this comes from Psalms, Psalm 120. He actually points out that Coverdale's Psalms are, in fact, what has given the language its richness rather than the King James Version per se. But in Crapp's last tape, Crapp lives in Kedar Street. And, this naming of the street achieves its full resonance when you can remember, now this is quotation rather than idiom, when you can remember that begins, woe is me, it makes sense of Crapp's predicament.
Yes, and to be fair, Crystal does quite clearly make a distinguish between quotation and allusion and idiomatic usage. And there are moments where he engages in some analysis of quotation, but the great mass of his reference is to that point where it becomes a part of our everyday speech because of the Bible. Though I have to say, rather than thinking of Beckett, I was sad to hear that P.G. Woodhouse wasn't there, because remember, Bertie did have a prize in scripture. that's not a little
different. Yes, but this is a different kind of influence, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Just the question here that you mentioned Coverdale there, he says that it's Coverdale in Geneva we have to thank for from strength to strength rather than the King James. The writing is on the wall again, I suppose, that's Daniel. And that's the powers that be.
Yes.
We use, that's very common in everyday speech, isn't it? Yes.
Yes.
Well, from
what
Romans.
What I got from this book was a terrific reminder of how everyday speech, all the time, has phrases and idioms from the various Bibles that he has studied, and that the Authorised Version gave full power to.
Yeah. It popularised them, as you said. Yes.
The book was kind of very self-reflexive in that way. It made us very conscious of the language again.
There's one phrase he uses, which is, or he cites, called, which is harden your heart, which is about Pharaoh, an instruction to Pharaoh from Exodus. And I remember actually years ago being on a flight from Atlanta and meeting an elderly lady who had grown up in Savannah, whose parents had read her the King James and Shakespeare every night from the age of 4 until 10. And I remember she came out with this wonderful sentence, which is, she had found a partner at the age of 77, which I thought was pretty good going. And she said, who would have thought that I, who have been so hard-hearted, could find faith, could find love? And I thought that this instance of hard-hearted, however, and again that sense of repetition of structure was utterly indebted to this Renaissance English in a way that you rarely hear. And it stuck with me because of that. Now, she made her living ghostwriting country and western singers' biographies, which perhaps is another explanation for why she spoke in this way. But I remember it having that immediate kind of grip on the ear that so many of these expressions do.
What an acute ear you have. You picked up on the repetitive strain in that. Jesus wept. Did you know the source of that?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Did you?
Yes.
And you, Selina?
No, I just thought it was something Australians said when they dropped their beer.
making me feel better. John on 11:35. Yes.
I thought of emailed as I would email Professor Crystal that he missed out one of my favourite usages as Sodom and Gomorrah, the Irish use of that in a kind of punning way he likes, because Sodom and Begorah.
And Begorah,
The difference between the abbey and the gate in the old days.
That's right.
I think it's one of the most brilliant Irish usages of biblical phrase.
Yeah. What's that Beecham said about Benjamin Britten up the twilight of the sods? Remember that?
That's right.
But the fall by the wayside is both in Mark And in Luke. And again, I suppose, you know, that underwrites his point that the New Testament is really the source of most of these that have entered the language.
I thought one of the most odd claims in the book was he says that the people who follow Jesus and who want to be his disciples are likely to talk like Jesus. I thought that was pretty bizarre. You know, I'm not sure that I ever heard anybody who I could say that person talks like Jesus quite. But maybe I'm being just a little unfair.
But the book has a bigger didactic aim as well, in that it does actually structure itself as a path through the Bible. And I think in some ways David Crystal may wish for it to be an aid to biblical study, or to be a companion piece to a kind of progressive reading through the book chapter by chapter. And perhaps in the anniversary year, where there are so many public events, particularly in Britain, organised around reading the entirety of the King James, this is, if you like, designed to be a kind of bedside companion to that task.
Oh, do you mean it prompted me to buy the new illustrated version that has just come out, and I'm sure it will prompt many people.
It organises the book in two ways. The first Old Testament is done chapter by chapter. Then he comes to the New Testament. He treats it thematically. Mm. And that, I think, is actually more interesting,
yes,
where he sees things like flesh or wine and food or noises and sounds, the way in which these are. And at that point, his own literary skill, I think, starts to display itself. I mean, this is a very skilled book. Because of the repetitious nature of the endless examples, becomes, I have to say, a little wearying. It's a book to sample, read short bits at a time, make an excellent loop.
Yes, I was thinking the smallest room in the house myself. Yes.
We've been discussing Begat, the King James Bible and the English Language by David Crystal, published by Oxford University Press. My thanks to Selina Guinness and Terence Brown. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.